Merci. Bonjour. That's it.
I can't help thinking about two experiences I had in college. My first class at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I went to school at Cornell University, which is built on a hill that would make this look like a flat plain. It was like this. Getting up for an 8 o'clock class into a room like this in an ancient building which had steam heat. And I was way up there, and the history professor, who wrote a marvelous book but talked on an absolutely even plane like this and very faintly so you could not hear him, and in the last row I was dead asleep every morning in about 3 minutes. So if, up there in the back, if you're asleep in a couple of minutes, I don't blame you. The other point, talking about the French, my mother's people were French, and when we were growing up, we didn't speak French, but we threw a lot of French expressions around, keller, till, I can't even think of several of them now, because the ubiquitous fermez la bouche. That I remember. And when I went to college again, I had to take a foreign language. So I figured, well, I know French. And in a classroom like this, they gave a test to determine which French class you were going to go into, the new, you know, novice French class, the medium, or the advanced. And I will never forget this. I told the professor after, it was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard of in my life. I'm very interested in drama and music and so on. The test consisted of the French club doing a little play, all in French. And then they handed you a paper test, which was all in English, asking you what was going on. Well, it was perfectly obvious what was going on in the play, so I answered all the questions in English, obviously, and was, you know, dumbfounded when they said, congratulations, you'll be in the advanced French course. I didn't know anything about French. Jim Tennyson, I couldn't help thinking, if you'd stuck with the rabbits, think of the size of the collection you'd have. As you'll see, some of the instruments that I'm going to show you, the mechanical musical instruments, are small. Just to give you a little example, I did not drive, or I would have brought some with me, and I came on the plane, so I was forced to bring little bitty things like this. Mechanical musical instruments probably translate for most of you into music box. This is what's called a manivelle, little child's toy. There are variations on this. Some of them very interesting. You play them in this direction, you get one song. You turn it in the other direction, you get another song. Some of them are made, if you turn them in either direction, you get the same song. This particular one, if you turn it backwards, you'll break it. Music boxes have been with us for a long time in various forms. I'm sure everybody's familiar with music box in one form or another. They've been used for a lot of different commercial devices. After World War II, Maytag put out one of the very early popular washing machines, clothes washing machines. And when it concluded its cycle, a little built-in music box would go bing, 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 bing. I can't find one. I have tried over and over to find these. When I learned about this, which was well into the 60s, I got to Maytag and said, surely you must have a lot of these stockpiled someplace for repairs, and they didn't know what I was talking about. Just to give you another example, most of you, I'm sure, are old enough to remember the days when if you went into a drugstore or a chemist, I believe they call it here, pharmacal center, whatever, and to the soda counter, they would make you a Coca-Cola or a Pepsi-Cola or whatever with syrup mixed with seltzer. This is the handle for that they would push on to get the elixir to come out into the glass, and then they would pour the seltzer in it. So every time you push down on this, can you imagine the kid that had to make sodas all day long?
Drink for Coke.
I think I'll hold a couple of the others till we get into this. My purpose here is to just simply show you that there is another whole different area of what you might wish to call recorded music. not in the sense that you are listening to a recording of somebody's performance done in the past, but the mechanical musical devices actually do the performing for you, so that if you have the fortune, for instance, to have, as I do, a Steinway Duart piano and a roll of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, you are listening to George Gershwin playing your piano. So it's a little bit different. What we are talking about here is, for all intents and purposes, a whole series of very unique, very interesting, I should say unique, can't be very unique, computers using binary language. You either play the note or you don't. That's all they are. And there are a number of different variations on obtaining that result. I noticed downstairs this book from the Vestal Press. If you're not familiar with it, I urge you, if you're involved in nostalgia at all, radio, electric trains, anything like this, pick this up. It's a magnificent organization. Harvey Rail, who runs the Vestal Press, don't read anything into the name other than the fact that it is located in Vestal, New York. Harvey started this. He was the dean of Broome County Technical College in Binghamton, which is right next to Vestal, and was interested in player pianos. This is about 30 years ago. And a young player piano technician had written a book called How to Restore a Player Piano. Stop and think for a minute. And somehow or other, I don't think Harvey even remembers now, he published the book. And which was an instant bestseller, and it is still advertised regularly in the Little Tiny Aid and Popular Mechanics and all these other hobbies and so on, and has since gone into publishing and or selling just tons of stuff in this field and a lot of others, and it's a magnificent thing. If you don't have one, pick it up, and that's a plug for Harvey. I have one more little plug, which is for our Yesteryear Museum. We have put out a whole series of postal commemorative cachet things to do with Edison, the American flag, mechanical music recordings, especially a lot of stuff to do with the centennial of recorded music. And I have a catalog here with me. It is over on the chair over there. If you'd like to pick one up, we'd be delighted. We have a lot of these things. Don't have everything, but we have most of it, including some belt buckles and other things. Only thing I would say is if you pick this up and you wish to write us, ignore the address on the catalog and pick up one of my cards, which is next to it, because we no longer use the box number that is here. Okay, I'm just going to rattle off a list of things, and given the context of our meeting here today, you can probably figure this out, but it's a rhetorical question. You may just kind of wonder, what do all of these things have in common? In deference to Bill, clocks, watches, chronographs, automata, carillons, harmonicas, accordions, trumpets, saxophones, calliopes, and calliopes. Yes, there is a difference. One is steam and the other is air. Don't ask me why. Nickelodeons, reed organs, pipe organs, flute organs, Dutch organs, dance hall organs, military band organs, theater organs, church organs, the stalactite organ, there's only one I understand, carousel organs, drums, bass, trap, snare, whatever, xylophones, wood and metal, bells and chimes of all kinds, triangles, celeste, blocks, cymbals, other sound effects, banjo, guitar, harps, pianos, zithers, violins, harpsichords, street pianos and organs, music boxes, cylinder and disc, from little toys like I showed you all the way up to very large. In effect, entire orchestras of musical instrument. All of these have at one time or another been developed and adapted, if you will, to play automatically. Self-playing musical devices. For someone in the audience who is an accomplished violinist, you may wonder, how the devil is that possible? How do you do that? Very carefully, mostly. In addition to which, if any of you happens to be a pilot or has been involved in aviation at all, you're familiar with the Link Aviation Trainer. If any of you worked for an elected official maybe 20 years ago, you're familiar with the Autotypist, which was the forerunner of the present automatic typewriters. Those ladies in the audience probably know what I mean when I talk about jacquard fabric, which comes out of the jacquard loom. All of these well, I should back up a little bit. The Jacquard loom preceded the music boxes and so on, the mechanical music, which I'm going to show you. There is a family that made Jacquard descended from that Jacquard, who also made music boxes. In the other cases, the automatic typewriters and the link trainer, both came out of families that made player pianos and used exactly the same technology with the stack and vacuum and compressed air and so on. Now, just to go very quickly, I want to show you some things on the slides, just to give you an idea of the vast family of instruments that we're talking about here. The device in the background, which you see the series of, where's the breeze coming from? It's okay, it'll be in focus at least part of the time. The device in the background, and I have it here, and I have a bunch of other demonstration items here, which you're welcome to look at when, at the end of the program, is a modern Jacquard loom program. And if you look at it, you will realize, for all intents and purposes, it is a very large continuing series of IBM punch cards, and that, of course, is what's in the middle of it. I hope you will pardon the puns in this. Now, I have some diagrams here, and they're out of a book, and I'm not the best photographer, and some of these may be slightly blurred at the edges. The earliest devices really came out of the Industrial Revolution, the Jacquard loom and so on, and some unknown person, I don't think we really know who, reasoned that if he took a very large wooden barrel, and some of them are maybe 10 feet or more in diameter, and around its outside put pegs in certain places, he could then rotate the barrel by weights or clockwork, have those pegs come around, lift an arm which would be attached to the bell, and then play the bell. And by varying the pattern of those pegs could vary the tune, and then he didn't have to be the carillonneur. If you've ever thought about this, a carillonneur, interesting person, has to be a very delicate-minded person because he has to be a musician and love music and the tunes that he's going to play. He also has to be rather strong because he has to climb the ladder to get up into the church tower and then play like this. Because these arms are, you know, maybe this long, and they're like 2x4s with a leather pad on the end to sort of keep him from... You know, the man is, you know, hearing these bells, climbing over this thing and everything. You think Quasimodo started that way? All right, so this will give you the idea of the very beginning. Well, that doesn't belong there. Well, yes, it does. Just to show you that there's another way, by using holes in a car which is traveling along. These actually travel in two pairs. If you notice the numbers on the left, says 257, 259, 261. There's another one next to it with the even numbers. Now let's take the idea of a barrel and flatten the surface out into a disc, and you put little pins on it. The top one is the very earliest musical box device, in which we think of a comb in a music box, if you ever really look at one, very much like a hair comb. I'm sure at some point we've all done this. Can you hear that? I'll try the other one. It's not hard like they used to be. Well, it's supposed to go do-do-do-do-do, right? Each tooth being a little smaller than the adjacent one. Now they're made on one steel piece with all the teeth cut out with slots between, but originally each one was separate. And you turn the disc. At the bottom, by producing a disc which has two sets of circles offset, if you'll notice the one comb is a little further away from the center pin than the other. In other words, the notes that play on the bottom cone go between the teeth on the one on the top. And what you do is you have a pin comes up, picks up the metal tooth on the comb, has to be steel, and as it passes it, the tooth vibrates and produces a note until another one comes along. That's the whole basis of a music box. Those two different kind of devices appeared in watches such as we see here, chronographs and the like. Oops, this is very much out of focus, but I left it in anyway. This is an interesting device, a little dial on a wooden handle, inside of which is a music box with no clockwork. It just has a weight like a centrifuge. And as you take the dial and turn it around like this, the weights will turn inside the dial and turn the music box. Music boxes in the 1880s, 90s, and so on were the instant fad like VCRs now. Everybody had to have them. In many cases, they were hidden. Of course, Victorian family albums, photo albums, were very popular. In most cases, the music box was hidden in the back. Usually, there would be either a celluloid window in that opening or maybe a printed piece of cardboard. You didn't even know it was there. The little clasp, when you opened the book and flattened out the clasp, was attached by a wire to the music box, and that would start the music box playing. This is courtesy of the Smithsonian exhibit some years ago, Music Machines American Style, typical of a little device which would be given to a child to play with and probably ruin. If you add to the musical device a series of cams, you now can come up with something that will make a little doll figure move around from one set of cans, and if you attach another cam to a little, like a penny whistle, that whistle can be made operate up and down, and then you put that down in the bottom of the work someplace, and on the top you put a pretty little bell, and the one cam pops it open, and the bird pops up and moves around and sings, and the other one operates a little organ. You could buy these little ones like this all the way up to very large ones, and in many of the large ones, which are now worth a great deal of money, it's an actual bird, which has been mounted on a brass innards and so on, and they actually program the device to sing the song of that bird. You could also buy them just in a plain, simple little box, which you push the button to make it go, to teach your live bird how to sing. This is another device which is very popular in Victorian times. It's a Christmas tree stand. Musical mechanism is inside. You wound it up, and then the cup, which was cast in which you fixed your Christmas tree, would turn around. Obviously, considerably smaller Christmas trees than we use now. This would be a tabletop. A little close-up on the little girl. She's just about to do what you should always tell somebody, don't do. Get your fingers out of there. Not only can you hurt yourself, but you can really ruin the music box. Just the oils and acids on your fingers can start the steel rusting. Now, from that to this is a bit of a jump, of course. But this shows you also Swiss-made cylinder music box, which has added to it three bells and a drum. If you notice, there are several handle sticking up, levers across the front. This has actually about five different combs in it, and you can pull off the bells or put them on, or pull off the drum and put them on. These were made by highly skilled craftsmen. Here's an example which shows you the work of a musician who lays out the music, the mathematician who figures it out on a graph-like device, the person who transfers that information to the where those pins have to be on the cylinder. One of those pins may contain 6 or 7 or 8 or 9,000 pins, one of those cylinders. Each one has to be positioned within a thousandth of an inch. It might take a couple of months to make one of those cylinders. Then it's put into a clockwork mechanism made by a clockwork somebody. Then you start with the case, which involves hardwood technology. You play one of these music boxes out of the case, doesn't sound like much. And you have inlaid wood and a lot of other things. Therefore, they were very expensive, each one unique. Not this one, but some of these music boxes in 1880, 1890 cost then $10,000, which is, I don't know for sure, someone else may know here, but I would guess somewhere up around what we would think of as $250,000. Unique items, one of a kind. This particular one has interchangeable cylinders. You have room for 3 or 4 additional cylinders in the drawer. It sits on a stand, and there are drawers in the end of the stand as well. There's a little more of a close-up. The bar across the front is a zither device. It's actually a form of damper with rolled-up rice paper, which gives you a plinky-plinky effect. That'll give you some of the idea of the complexity of these cylinders. Here's another one which shows more bells inside. The main thing about this is the cabinet maker's art. It's that famous optical illusion that looks like steps going up or down, depending on whether you blinked or not. And it goes all the way around and on the top and so on. All inlaid wood marquetry. A little hard to see in this picture, but there are six bells played by three little Mandarin figures, each one arm playing one bell. There's another one that has two of these figures. Now, it was possible after a while to come up with the idea that you could reach in, take this cylinder out, put it in the drawer, and put another cylinder back. Regarding that alignment of those pins I told you about, that's very complicated, and you still had to have every cylinder handmade. So a man named Ehrlich in the Leipzig area in Germany said, if we can transfer the pins, handmade cylinders and so on, to a disc, we can stamp them out on a press, make them multiple units, mass produced. But how are you going to have a device where you can take this out and put it back in and take it out and put it back in and not mess up the comb, which is very delicate? So he interjected between the disc, which is the program device, and the comb, a gear, which is called a star tooth. And when the little lug on the bottom of the disc, which corresponds to the pin, comes around, it hits one tooth on the star wheel, turns the star wheel if it has six teeth, one-sixth of the distance. One of the other tooth plucks the comb. Now you could get into disc music boxes. It's interesting that about 10, 15, 20 years later, the talking machine went through the same thing from cylinder to disc for much the same reason. It was very hard to mass produce cylinders. I mentioned before zither. This is a disc operated zither. You could buy them with or without the clock mechanism. This is, will show you, as you see, there are three different discs there, three different edge drive mechanisms, and three different forms of lugs on the bottom. The top left is the Regina, where they actually cut out a strip of metal and then rolled it up underneath to produce a little curled tab. The one on the right actually is like a scoop that's just pushed down, very much like a carrot grater. The one on the lower left is plastic, and just has little bumps that are molded in. The plastic one is a much more recent device. The two metal ones go back to about 1890, 95. The newer one is post-war. And the drive teeth also, if you notice, are all different. It really doesn't matter how, but they were all made different by different manufacturers to avoid patent difficulties. When you brought the discs, you brought them from a dealer, and he had a list. And they brought these things out to Hit Parade of the Week. They would bring out new tunes. And there are a lot of tunes on these discs which everybody says, what the hell is that? And you play it and you say, I still don't know what the hell it is. I mean, well, they did the same thing that the record companies do now. They would put out a record, there would be a hit song. And for instance, I have a couple of records that are George M. Cohan songs. One is called, and this is really funny for Cohan, the U.S. flag waver of all. The song is called Under Any Old Flag at All, very un-Cohan-like. Did not make a hit, but they probably said, oh great, another Cohan song about a flag, it's going to be a hit, make it. Never got anywhere. And they constantly came out with more and more. They even had the Stella Music Box Disc of the Month Club. I kid you not. Now we're getting into something a little bigger. Looks like some kind of a very elaborate chest of drawers or something with stained glass and a painted panel in the middle and everything, except what is the chest of drawers doing with that funny handle over on the right side? Now, you open up something like this. Now what you have is an English initial jukebox. You see the slot over there, it takes those big old-fashioned English pennies. You have a selection of 10 songs, which could be changed by the root man. And the discs are across the bottom in a toast rack-like device, and you turn a knob to the song that you wish to hear, put in the coin, flip a lever, and various different clockwork motors will find the record that you want and bring it up into the position, which is the playing position. Here's a non-automatic one where you have storage in the bottom. Looks very familiar to some of the early talking machines. Regina was the American arm originally of the Polyphon company, which was a German company which in turn came from the Symphonian Company, which was a German company. They created Polyphon to get into the British market, and then they sent some people over here and thought, well, maybe there's a little bit of a market in the United States. So they shipped Polyphon parts to the United States, assembled them initially in Newark and then in Rahway, New Jersey. And Regina took off and wound up making more music boxes and more discs for them than all of the other 42 or 45 manufacturers with about 300 different combinations of sizes and types. All of the others in the world combined did not make as many as Regina made. Name sound familiar to you? Same company. People that make the vacuum cleaners. Got to keep those people busy somehow. This is a desk, magnificent, only made about 10 of these. Plays a record on the right side. You can just barely see there's a vertical storage area on the left. The two lower right drawers on the right were actual drawers. This shows how you put it on and put the hold down lever on. Now we get back to the jukebox idea. This is for a program from around 1890s. Would be on the side of the music box. It shows you how to operate it. You picked what you wanted. This is a picture of, on the lower right side is the Regina Corona, which is the jukebox style version, but this will show you they came in sizes which play discs all the way from 8 inches in diameter to 32 inches. You may recognize some of those. Now let's just show how it works. They're all lined up in the bottom. They have 12 records. You twist a dial to the number you want, you push another lever, and up comes the disc. One motor finds the disc and lifts it into position, and then another one takes over and plays it. This is a Regina clock. It's a Seth Thomas clock with a Regina mechanism in the front. Again, this was coin operated. Again, the lists of discs. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different titles in many different sizes. This should look familiar to you. It's a music box. No, it's a talking machine. No, it's both. If you'll notice, it says Regina phone. This same style was made in three forms. In the inside of the lid, where that lighter piece of veneer is, it would say Regina or Regina foam, or it would say Columbia Graphenola, or it would say nothing, in which case they wanted to sell it through somebody who wasn't a dealer for either one. It plays both the music box discs and disc recordings. The Polyphon Company, its parent company in Germany, when the talking machine began to take over, because now you could have a talking machine could sound like anything, a music box can only sound like a music box. You could have records of a music box, although I've never run into any old ones. So they had a problem. Polyphon was smart. They got into the record business, and I believe they're still in the record business. Regina, for some reason, never did. They made record players, but they never made record recordings themselves. Some of the cases, as you saw, were magnificent. That one, by the way, if you notice on the corner, see the carved lion's heads? These are not pressed. They're carved. Beautiful machine. This is a little hard to tell the size of these. I have them over here. They're approximately 4 inches in diameter. Oh, here's another version of the Regina phone, serpentine case, with the giant Columbia-type horn and arm, for good reason. They had a working relationship with Columbia. This is a Polyphon disc. That's their trademark, the goddess of music. Machines were very elaborate. This is pressed wood carving. I don't mean pressed wood, it's wood, but the design is pressed in, very common in the Victorian era. This happens to be a machine called an Olympia, which it happened that Admiral Dewey had one of these on his flagship. And boy, did this company get a lot of money out of that. After Dewey's exploits, they had ads everywhere saying this is the machine that Dewey took with him. Here's a Regina disc, 15 and a half inch, which is the most popular, although, as I said, they go all the way up to 32. Here's another couple of different versions. The one on the right is a Symphonian from Germany. I think the left one probably is also. Here's a Fenian disc, many, many different names. And as you see, different types. This is actually anodized blue. They're steel discs with a gold design on them. Again, they tried to make them all look different. This is a polyphone made in Germany for the British market. The interesting thing about this is instead of a spring motor similar to the Edison machines and so on, this one has a coil spring, runs across the back, and as you crank it up, a plate on one end compresses it, and then as it moves out, it would turn the record player. Very, very unusual. Okay, so much for music boxes as such. Now we'll go back to the idea of the barrel. Take the Carillon-type barrel, a wooden barrel, and now we're going to have it operate an organ by lifting arms, which will lift a valve, which you see on the bottom, allow the one valve for every pipe on the organ, allow the air to come out through the pipe, which is in the back, and each one, of course, is tuned to a different note. I would point out that on the music boxes, this is not true with the organs, I don't think, but on the music boxes, you would assume that those music boxes are tuned like a piano, one key per note, or vice versa. Not true. When they made them up, the musician figured out, okay, these are the notes we're going to use for these songs, four tunes, six tunes, eight tunes, whatever it may have been. Therefore, all of the notes that do not appear on this cylinder, we don't need. On the other hand, when you strike something to vibrate, like a bass note, let's say, on a piano, or the bass notes on a music box, it's vibrating, it decays very slowly before it finally comes to rest. Therefore, if you want to play it again and another pin comes around and hit it, what happens is it's still vibrating and it's going to go and then stop, and then you'll pluck it and get the note. If you've ever heard a music box and you hear a funny chirping noise, chirp, 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 it's sort of like a chuff on an organ, but it isn't. That's what it's doing. It's at very high speed. So what they would do is they realize, well, we can only re-hit the note just so quickly, particularly in the bass notes. Therefore, you put in two, or three, or four, or five. I've seen as many as six teeth in a row. They're all the same note. Therefore, you cannot put just any cylinder in that box. Okay, here you could do otherwise. And then with an organ note, you want to sustain notes. On a music box, you just have to keep playing that note over and over and over again. Organ, you can sustain the note. So what you do is you have little pins, and then you have what are called staples, for obvious reasons, which will sustain those notes for whatever length of time is necessary by holding that open. This is a wooden barrel organ. The bellows is in the front. The pipes are across the back. This is very early, although not as early as the ones that Bill Malik's going to tell you about. This is probably around 1840 or so. Not very beautiful looking, but nice sounding. This, of course, is the form of barrel organ that we may be most familiar with. This is a little longer than the one we are used to seeing, maybe the older folks in the orchestra. Anyway, fellow all dressed up, strap around his shoulder, organ with a little leg sticking down so he could rest it when he wanted to, and a leash, maybe not a leash, a little monkey that would run around, tip his hat, hold his hat out, and take some money. Therefore, these are generically called monkey organs, or hurdy-gurdies, which is a misnomer, because a hurdy-gurdy or a viol is actually a very early lute-type stringed instrument which was run by turning a crank which took a round circle of some sort of material and some wax or something, and it just ground on the string, and you played the string with a keyboard. And because it was grinding, you'd get this characteristic droning sound, very much like a bagpipe, although not quite that bad. This rrr. And therefore, this sound seemed to remind people of that sound. And most people today don't know what an original hurdy-gurdy is, but they may remember this. So they wound up calling this a hurdy-gurdy. This will give you, I'm not going to go through all this explanation, but it'll give you some idea of the complexity involved inside an organ. You have the barrel, you have the crank to turn it, you have to operate all those different bellows and things, and then, of course, ultimately to produce air through a pipe in a particular series. another different version. Obviously, these are a little larger. An organ like this on the market today would run probably about $8,000. And the smaller ones could be very small, maybe 15, 18 inches tall and wide, would run, fully restored, and some of the names like Bacigalupi, for instance, bring a lot of money, maybe $5,000-$6,000 even for a little one. The monkeys are cheaper, but the organs are. This is the most popular form of organ, the Gemrotor organ, and they could manufacture these wooden cobs, which are solid, with metal pins in them, very inexpensively. They didn't use staples. If they want to sustain a note, they just put a whole bunch of pins, one right after another, like brads. This was sold through catalogs like the Sears Roebuck catalog, and you could write for the records. I don't know whether you can see over the right. You buy the organ for $3.95 and at various different times for competitive reasons, three or four or five or six or seven records for a dollar. There are many different versions of this. The reason I put this in here, over on the right, the thin strips are, you will see, very, very similar to the Jacquard loom strips that I showed you, except they're not tied together. They would have been in this case. That is a mechanical musical device for an organ. To the right of it is what we call book music, which is a continuous strip of cardboard which feeds through. It's stacked up accordion style on one side, feeds through the instrument, and then it's stacked up accordion style on the other side. In between, that orangish box would hold, and I don't know where the device is. It should be right there, but I don't see it. Well, I'll show it to you later. A roll-operated harmonica, in case you don't know how to play a harmonica. There's the book music on the right. We also had round cardboard discs. Obviously, this is an organ disc with a sustained note. Interestingly enough, this was also produced by the same Ehrlich who came up with the disc music box. Here's the demonstration that shows how the book music works. A lot of the early gigantic German and Dutch organs operated with this kind of music. They are still being cut, by the way, in Belgium and Holland and Germany for certain organs. This shows you how a continuous strip would go over a harmonica-like, whatever you want to call it, the bar which has the openings for the notes. This is for a reed organ. In essence, all it is a very large harmonica. Here's an accordion. The strip went inside one end, and all the person that played it did was squeeze the thing back and forth to get the air, and one hand was squeezing a handle which advanced the music to play the music. You didn't have to know how to play the accordion. Here's another version of a organette or a paper roll organ. There were many of these made, all of them different, again, for patent avoidance. It was made by Wilcox and White, a very famous name in the organ field. Here's another different version of a very popular series of organs that were made with very heavy paper. And you could buy this same mechanism about five or six different styles of cases. This is one of them, same roll, but it looks quite different. Has a chimney on it, interestingly enough. There was one of these, and I only got a picture of it, which is made by the Ithaca Calendar Clock Company in Ithaca, New York. And you actually took the pneumatic mechanism, which provided the air, and you squeezed it. And in so doing, you had a little ratchet arm that would move the music through, no clockwork mechanism, and the music would go through at varying tempi. The actual sheet of music would change its tempo according to whether you had a quarter note or a half note or a full note. It's the strangest thing you've ever seen. Now we're getting into, well, here's the, shows how the reed organ discs work. The top one has a probably metal reinforced hole where a little arm actually goes up into the hole and opens the access to the pipe. The bottom one has lugs sticking down of one form or another. Remember, all these are the same thing as the hole in the IBM cart. The note plays or it doesn't play, one or zero. Plus or minus, it's binary language. A lot of the discs were very different, as I said, they could all be the same, but they had to be different because they were different companies. This was set up with a strap so you could sort of go into competition with the guy with the monkey. This is an interesting device. The organ would have sat at about, let's say, the 3 o'clock position and would have extended into about the middle of the hall and past the outside of the hall. The disc hung out into the air. That way you could get a very large surface, longer music on a disc without having the organ be so big, because obviously the bigger the organ, the heavier. Now just think about this for a minute. The organ mechanism is suspended within a square box on an axle, and the entire organ mechanism turns underneath inside the box, and the music stays still. Again, just to avoid somebody else's patent. I have one of those here, too. Here's the same thing, except this is the disc turns instead of the organ. Here's a larger version of a reed organ that would be operated, not to be a huge disc, just to make it a bigger organ. Bigger organ, more sound. Here's the harmonica I talked about. You can't see, you blow into the other side, there's a mouthpiece, and you just crank it through. When you get through, you crank it back. These were widely sold by Sears, Roebuck, and other companies of that sort. They made saxophones. I don't have a picture of it here. QRF, which is the only royal company that's been in business since way back around the turn of the century, still in business in Buffalo, by the way. If any of you was driving down through Buffalo, go see the QRS factory. It's fascinating. You'll be delighted to see it. This is a paper royal operated trumpet. I remember I rattled off all those instruments? You didn't believe me. Here's another version of a rather large, what we call a cabinet roll organ. Those rolls, by the way, usually are removable. There's a round door on the other side. You can pull it out and put another one in. You could have one made up with popular tunes. You can get these, if you can find them, with popular tunes from all the way from the Victorian era up into the, World War II. Now, this is a rather elaborate piece of furniture, rather large. But this is what's inside it. If you think the front's elaborate, drums, I can't even tell what's all in there. The motor that runs it all is down in the bottom, and it's paper roll operated, but you can also operate it. They don't have to have a keyboard, but they put one in if you want to use it. Now, this may look a little more familiar to some of you. This is a roll operated, but also manually operated, two manual theater organ, or possibly, oops. You know what an organ keyboard looks like. That'll give you an idea, this off a record cover, of some of the elaborateness of some of these machines. As you can imagine, the one in the middle top was loud. And that was its purpose, to bring people to the carnival or the circus or whatever it was that it was traveling with. There's a marvelous gentleman named Paul Eakins, who runs the Gay 90s Melody Museum in Sykeston, Missouri, I'm not even sure where it is. I've been there, but I couldn't tell you to get there. You notice it says, after 1,309 hours. That is the amount of time it took to restore that machine. So if you want to buy a restored machine, you better have a pretty good sized bank account. Lest you think that these things, some of them aren't large. This is a circus gigantic organ with lots and lots and lots of brass, including a calliope up in the front. This kind of thing, by the way, you can see if you go to Baraboo, Wisconsin. Now we get into another situation. Now we have a piece of paper running over, and it's picking up little levers, and it just operates through a air channel on the bottom. It's just a different variation on how these work, and this is what powers something like that. Now, you can't tell it from that picture, but that organ is approximately 25 feet wide. There are some that are 40 to 60 feet wide, and will imitate an entire orchestra. Again, we have a barrel-operated device that would play like a zither or a piano, but we were talking last night, a group of us, a cymbal on it would be that kind of a sound. Again, a large barrel organ with these large trumpet pipes. This is a Velti made in Germany, magnificent machine. And the cases, of course, are magnificently carved and filled in and so on. This is a Philips, it's a Dutch, or Belgian machine with an accordion on the top. I think this is a Maesto, which is the equivalent of a very large church organ, all packed in together. Just in case you don't think These things are large. It'll give you an idea how big they are. Simple enough. If you notice the protruding round thing at the top, this is what's inside of it. We're out of focus. Interesting note, you notice the violins are upside down. Each one actually has one string. The string tension is changed with a little bellows that pulls on the string and a mechanical device, and then when they want that violin to play, the violin moves in and out. It's the weirdest thing to watch you've ever seen. In the middle, the playing position of the violin, you'll notice is something round. There is a woven round wheel that looks like a bicycle wheel where the spokes are made out of string. And they don't come all the way into the middle. They come about 4 or 5 inches in, and they're all straight, of course, but many, many, many of them, so you wind up with, in effect, a round device. The wheel goes around, and the violins are stationary. And it's fascinating to watch because the wheel slows down and speeds up, and these violins are coming in and out to play. Very elaborate piano, of course, operated by a barrel. Multiple barrel set. Drums. Triangle. This is just another system to perform it. Now what we I'm sorry, let me go back to that. What we have here now is the tracker bar, as it's called, for a player piano. I'm sure you've all seen a player piano at one point or another. Each note is connected with a little hole in the tracker bar, which is normally under vacuum when it is covered by the paper in the roll. When a hole comes over that particular hole for, let's say, middle C, air rushes down into the tube, goes to a little bellows, like a miniature fireplace bellows. The bellows, which is collapsed because it's normally under vacuum, flies open, opens another valve, which trips the, actually moves the hammer on the piano, and then that in turn strikes the key. This is the heart of any player piano, reproducing piano, whatever. Now, the early player pianos were not player pianos, they were piano players. It was a device that looked like sort of a very large sewing machine. You put the roll in the top, all the mechanical and pneumatic stuff was inside, and it had little wooden fingers across the back. You pushed it up to your existing piano, and it played your piano. Now, this will show you a little better how it works. Little fingers that come out and grab all of the keys. Then they started building them into the piano. Now this is, you probably have heard the name pianola. It is a registered trademark of the Aeolian Company, but it also unfortunately became the generic term for player pianos. Just as in England they call any disc machine a gramophone, in this country we call any kind of talking machine a phonograph. That's not correct. Phonograph is the trademark for an Edison cylinder machine. Initially, they built all the mechanical and pneumatic stuff in this column. And this is not a piano player. It's actually just a column built down in the bottom of the piano. Then they started to figure out how to build them in. A player piano, upright player piano, is a little easier than a grand, but they did figure out how to do it with a grand. Now, this may look familiar to you, how to sit down and have a ball with a player piano. The roll is in the center of the piano, and it will play the keys. And what this young lady is doing is moving some levers, which will actually build expression into the performance. The roll of a regular player piano has no way to duplicate crescendo and the various things that constitute expression. Every note comes out as loud as every other note. This is an interesting piano. If you'll notice, there's a record player built into the piano on the left, cylinder machine. The horn is behind the top spool of the player roll in the middle. And QRS and a couple of other companies put out record and roll combinations. And if you started them synchronized at the right speed, they would play together. Or else QRS would say, play this with Victor number so-and-so. Unfortunately, there are not too many of them existing. Again, a rather unusual looking piano. This is probably produced for a very young Liberace, maybe on his second birthday. Again, another form, except that this is not a monkey organ. This is a miniature street piano. And these street pianos came in two forms. One just played the notes, and there's what they call a reiterating street piano, where it's constantly, you know, like a mandolin version all the time. This is a miniature version. I'm trying to figure what, okay, what it is they've got the music laid out on the top so you can see what it is. Just showing you how complicated some of these can be. This is a strange mechanism because you have two sets of hammers, one coming up from the bottom, one coming down from the top. Two-whirl mechanism. While one whirl was playing, the other one was rewinding. You never did get any respite at all. Now, some of these came in extremely elaborate cases, as you can see from this. This is from the Aeolian Company, which came up with a system called the duo art, which would do what the player piano would do, but would also do everything else that the pianist could do, crescendo, attack, the whole thing, all built into the coding and additional devices within the piano. Again, as I said, George Gershwin playing his Rhapsody in Blue, all the subtleties on my piano. Here's another version. This is a German Velti. Reproducing piano. We'll also play the 88 note rolls, by the way. And this will give you an idea of the quandary that be faces somebody if you're going to go into this. What kind of rolls do I get? The left-hand roll is a dual pipe organ for the Aeolian Skinner organ. The one on the bottom is the QRS play-a-sax roll. Coming around to the lower right with the orange box is for the roll monica. In the middle is the Ampico. Now, Dual-Art on the upper right was the Aeolian's reproducing system. So American Piano Company, which produced a number of others, Knabe, and some of the other pianos, they decided, well, we'll come up with one called Ampico for American Piano Company. If you'll notice, that's Rachmaninoff. The top one is a semi-cardboard roll. And the one on the right, we're very proud of. That's UB Blake performing Rhapsody in Blue, which he did the world premiere of that piece about 3 weeks before he made that roll in 1973 when he was 90 years old at a performance for our concert. Did I say in Blue?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Rhapsody in Ragtime. Thank you. Now, again, you want to pick out which is the one for yours? It is very confusing, and I could go through this. There are some very famous pianists in it, and let me just back up one point. Notice the ends of the rolls are all different, too, the pins and the flanges, all patterns. I think you've heard of him. He played the Steinway, and he made a deal with Aeolian, and boy, they really went for it. Aeolian Hall in New York, which is where Rhapsody in Blue was premiered. There is, as I said, a two-whirl set of Gershwin playing it. Now, these things became enormously popular in the 20s or so. I've got about 1 minute. This is a beautifully lithographed label from Cigar Box, Dual Art Cigars. This shows you what lengths various collectors will go to. A fellow in Massachusetts that I bought a piano from. In the meantime, he'd given up on pianos and decided I'm going to buy an MG, so he got MG on his license plate. He told me when he went to the motor vehicle people because he wanted to get the license plate to say duo art, they said, this has to be dirty. He finally went in with a whole raft of catalogs and rolls and all kinds of things to convince him that he should have it. All right, these are just some of the great artists that made these reproducing rolls from about 1903 up to the crash in 1929, and I'm sure you'll know some of these names. Some of them are going to surprise you. I'm sure you're familiar with that. That's the granddaddy of the present conductor. Farrar playing a piano? Yeah, she was a composer and played the piano. You know that Chrysler played the piano also. Groffé, very young man when he made these roles, but also had quite a reputation arranging for Paul Whiteman and so on. This is before the Grand Canyon Suite. No, it's not who you think it is. He doesn't have a beard. Guadalmara Reich was very young when she began making duo art rolls. I'm very proud of a couple of rolls that I have in my collection, which she autographed in the 60s. Very fine pianist. And of course, the papa of them all. I should give credit to a particular book This is called The Mechanical Music Cabinet. It was published in Germany by a man named Siegfried Wendel, and some, but not all, of the illustrations in there, including all of those diagrams, are from that book. Excellent book. That'll give you some of the things I was trying to show you before, and I have them here, and I'd be glad to answer any questions or show them to you, but I would ask you, please, don't take them off the table, because some of these rolls are very fragile. They tear, and then they're worthless. Thank you.